They Can't Take That Away From Me, that was played by Duke Jordan at the piano, and we heard from Gene Ramey on bass, recorded in 1954. Well, this is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 12 minutes after 4 o'clock. Joining me in the studio now is Rita Mae Brown. She is a novelist and a lesbian feminist, and divides her time writing and working with feminist organizations. Rita Mae Brown's first novel, Ruby Fruit Jungle, was the story of a girl growing up and discovering she is gay and likes it. The book wound up having a very large following. It was first printed by a small feminist press called Daughters Incorporated. It sold so well that Bantam later brought the commercial rights to it. Her second novel has just been published by Harper & Row, and it's called Six of One. It's the story of two sisters from childhood to old age who, as Brown says, carry on like trash together, but underneath this surface of hostility, they love each other a lot. Rita Mae Brown has been a teacher at the Women's Writing Center in Cazenovia, New York. She's presently a member of the National Gay Task Force and is on the advisory board for the National Women's Political Caucus. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. It's nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again. Rita was on the show about a year ago, and that was shortly after voting in Florida on the gay rights bill there. Well, last time you were here, Ruby Fruit Jungle novel was bought by Bantam and in paperback. And before we talk about what you've been doing recently, I'd be interested in hearing how Ruby Fruit is doing.
Ruby Fruit did very well. It did well for Daughters, and it did so well for Bantam that they just went back for another printing, which is amazing. It's curious that there are so many different Americas. There's the America that's homophobic, that hates black people, that despises Asian Americans and Chicanos, the America that would cut off welfare mothers because they think they're on the dole and not working. And then there's the America that's progressive, wants to look at life in new ways, thinks racism is disgusting, sexism is a blot in the national character, and is willing to ask questions about, yes, there are other ways to live your life. That's the America that buys Ruby Fruit and continues to support it, and I'm sure support Fresh Air as well. And the movie, there's supposed to be a movie made of the novel. And I did the screenplay with one of the producers, Arnie Reisman, which was a high. Loved doing it. Loved working with him. Loved it so much we wrote a second screenplay, which is a murder mystery in Bloomingdale's. We just finished that about 6 weeks ago, just before I hit the road. And the producers are raising up the money for the film. They need $2 million, which, if any of your listeners are aware of the film community, this is an extremely low-budget feature. But they think it can be done on a shoestring and they're trying.
Are you going to be involved with the casting at all once the
movie
is ready?
Yeah. They've given me a fair amount of input. Now, I don't have any contractual obligation. If they wanted to cut me out, they could. But, Terry, you know me well enough, that'd be the kiss of death. I'd get them forever. So they just better shut up and let me put my hand in it. Because I know this story and these people better than they do. So they'd be very foolish not to make use of me as an artistic advisor.
You know, since Ruby Fruit was initially published, there's been a lot of women's novels that have been written, not necessarily novels about gay women, but at least a few of the women's novels about women discovering women's liberation and feminism that have come out over the past couple of years, it seems that most of the main characters sample gayness at some point, that you know, they start off in marriage or as heterosexuals, meet someone, get a crush on them, maybe not fall in love, a woman, sleep with them, and usually leave that kind of gay relationship. But I just think it's interesting that, you know, in the mainstream of women's novels, lesbianism has entered in as at least something that is sampled.
I think what's happening to many of us is we're curious about our own lives. And you will ask questions about yourself if you begin to challenge yourself in those ways. Doesn't mean you're going to go in that direction, but it means that you have to re-examine the fact that you've take sexuality for granted. And that's very limiting. Makes for dull and narrow people. I don't take it for granted. I don't think you are who you sleep with. I think that's one of the most destructive concepts in the world. I mean, it seems to me that's the basis of sexism in many ways, that to determine who you are on the basis of sexual function is dumb. I mean, I can't even think of a nice word for it. It's just dumb. And I suppose that people who have lived unquestioning lives, when they do come into contact with feminism, would think about that and perhaps even sample it in some kind of curious way. But I have to tell you pretty bluntly, I'm not interested in sex. I'm interested in love. And I think it's quite an admission of the immaturity of America and Americans that we continue to harp on sex and we don't talk about love. We don't talk about how people sustain relationships, be they physical or non-physical. We don't talk how we emotionally support one another, and we don't talk about how we are responsible to the communities in which we live. It just seems to me that we're taking a very junior high school approach to human relationships by constantly harping on our plumbing. And that's what sex is. It's an exercise in plumbing. So I get real uneasy when there's this sexual emphasis in novels or in conversations about feminism or gay rights. It just seems to me that it's buying into the oppression. It's looking at ourselves the way that the oppressor looks at us.
Well, how did you try to reconcile that in your new novel, Six of One?
Six of One... it's hard for me to talk about the book. I'm so close to it, and I love the people in it so deeply. It is about two sisters from 1909 to 1980, and it's their relationship, the way that they both undermined one another, which we often do, yet the ways in which they were devoted to one another and tried to help in times of crisis. You see the two sisters, Julia and Louise, with their mother, the way the mother tries to bring the girls up and give them some standards and teach them to take care of one another. Then you see them grow, get married, raise their families. And you see all of this in the context of this town, Runnymede, which is set smack on the Mason-Dixon line. Of course, you know me. There's no way I could not get that in there. I got to pit the South against the North every chance I get.
It's because you've lived in both.
Mm-hmm. And I think there is a difference. I think there are many Americas, and South and North is yet one more difference. But for me, it's fun. It's a comic difference. And that's the force of the book. It's this relationship. It's the pain as well as the fun, and it's really about love and how people keep themselves together. I'm so tired, Terry, of books with self-pitying characters who whine and bitch about their fate. Here are two women, and they're two women that I know. I mean, I know them from real life, who were not handed aces, kings, and queens when they were dealt the old cards of life. They came from an economic hard place, but they managed to live their lives with dignity, and they managed to keep their sense of humor. And I think that's what excites me about people. It's the people who keep trying and who try to be productive. I'm not excited by Son of Sam. You know, I mean, sure, we need books about it. We need to know why those characters happen. But for this culture to focus on the destructive and alienated character, it seems to me creates more destructive and alienated characters. We need to hear about people who try to hold it together.
I think that a lot of your readers who read Ruby Fruit were probably or are going to probably be surprised when they find that the two main characters, the two sisters Lee referred to, are not lesbians. You know, they're both married, and there is a gay character in the book, but she's not the character around which the whole story focuses. Mm-hmm. Was that just the way it fell that you wanted to write about two other women? I mean, was it a political decision to not write your book about a gay woman like you did in Ruby Fruit?
No, it wasn't a political decision at all. Books are like babies. They tell you when they're ready to come. I think sometimes people who are not writers assume that a writer has total control over medium and that every selection is a terribly conscious one. Whoever's listening out there, writing is often... an irrational act. I mean, you have a story, you feel it coming, but those characters are so real, they will take you in directions you might not have thought of. I mean, they literally come to life. And that's what happened to me in this book. That's what happens to me in every book that I write. And I can't write for an audience. I can't say, okay, gay women, here's a book just for you, because I can't write that way. That's not how my mind works. I just have to do what's in me to do. The next novel that I'm working on is about a black family and a white family in Montgomery, Alabama. I don't even know how many gay people are going to be in that book, but I know that that book's ready and I have to do it. And there's a deep need in doing that. It's very dangerous when people begin to limit writers because it's a form of censorship. The fact that I am gay does not mean that I can't participate and identify with lives that are different than my own. The fact that I'm white doesn't mean that I can't try to understand and vicariously live an Asian American life. And if we keep accepting the oppressor's definition of ourself, we're never going to grow. We're never going to break out of that circle of oppression and link hands with people who we think are different than ourselves, but on closer examination, really are not.
You grew up in a small town in rural Pennsylvania, and then moved to Florida for a while, and then when you got older, moved to New York, and now live in L.A., and New York and L.A. are both at opposite ends of the coast, as opposed to being north and south, and being mm-hmm. opposite in that respect, and they're both really large cities. I'm wondering why you, in this novel, you know, focused it in a small town. I guess a lot of your concerns are still wrapped up in that.
I love small towns, because people know one another. They have to tolerate one another in a way they don't in a big city. Conventional wisdom always tells you that life is more liberal in big cities. My experience has been just the reverse, that there's so many people in a large city like Philadelphia that people can disregard one another more easily. They can have contempt for someone who is not like them and literally have a Dixie cup mentality, just crush people and toss them aside. In a small town, you can't do that. You may not like the way somebody lives. You may not like the fact that someone is gay or that somebody else is a Jew. And in small towns, those things are big differences. But you have to live with that person, so you make adjustments. I think that's very healthy. I like that. I liked coming from that, and I want to return to it. My living in L.A. is really a tour of duty. It's like being sent to Korea for 3 years. I have to do it, and I'm doing it, and as soon as I can get away, I will.
What's making you do it?
I want access to the film industry, and I've done 2 screenplays with Arnie, and I got my first opportunity to do one by myself for Roger Corman, who discovered Francis Ford Coppola and Marty Scorsese. So, I'm eager for the chance to work with him. And I want to get enough reputation so that people in the business know I can produce a screenplay, so that in a year or two I can mail them in from Pago Pago if I want, but that I don't have to be in Los Angeles to do it. And I'm not bad rapping L.A. I happen to like the city, but I don't belong in big cities. It doesn't matter where it is. I wouldn't even belong in Philadelphia. I should be in the country. It's where I feel most comfortable.
This film part is one of the, I guess, autobiographical parts of Rita Mae Brown's life in Ruby Fruit Jungle, just in the sense that she, too, comes from a small town in Pennsylvania and ends up going to New York to study film. I guess it's really finally working out. I mean, that one of your ambitions is really, you know, on the verge of being fulfilled.
Yeah, only took me 33 years.
Well, it's not a very long time. I mean, you weren't born wanting to be a filmmaker. We have to think of that.
No, I was born wanting to be a writer. Writing is the primary expression for me.
You know, Rita, when I saw your new book, first thing as usual, you see the cover, and we all know you can't judge a book by the cover, but when I turned it over and I saw your picture, I just hardly knew what to do. It's
I hope you screamed.
Oh, I didn't scream, but I looked at it very questioningly. I don't know if you know what Rita Mae Brown looks like, but she's a very attractive woman, but doesn't walk around, you know, in glamorous sheath dresses with exotic hairdos. You're not wearing any makeup now or anything. On this picture on the back is this woman who stares at me with a sense of the exotic, of mystery, very glamorous, with hair swept back and high cheekbones accentuated. It's a very exotic pose. And, Rita, I asked you when you walked in here, who took that picture?
Victor Skribneski took the picture. And as usual, it's my sense of humor. I couldn't resist. I can never resist being irreverent. No matter what it is, if people expect me to come in combat boots, I just have to come in high heels. It's part of my nature to make fun of things. When I saw that picture, I howled. I loved it so much. I just think it's wonderful. Wonderful in a funny way to me, because I think glamour is both funny and enlightening, in a sense, that you can alter your appearance if you want to. Of course, the trouble is if you start believing in it, then you're in big trouble. But I guess only people who know me would know how funny I think that picture is. Other people would look at it and think, gosh, maybe she's going to go on the cover of Cosmo next.
Yeah, really. Well, you know, I started to wonder whether, you know, working with a major commercial press, you know, that perhaps they insisted that you look mysterious and beautiful.
No, they hated it. They didn't want me to do it at all. I insisted on it. I said, this is my book, Sugar Baby, and I'm putting what I want on the back of it, and you just like it. And they said, well, we don't like it. We want you to look intellectual and serious and mature. And I said, the hell with that. I don't want to look intellectual and serious and mature. That's boring as batshit.
Oh, we have to be careful. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the political issues that you've been working now. You're still working with the Gay Task Force and with another...
National Women's Political Caucus.
Yeah. I wanted to comment on your absence at the NOW meeting this weekend.
I never go.
Yeah.
They threw me out in 1968, and I haven't been back yet.
Why were you thrown out then?
Because I raised lesbianism as an issue, and their ovaries just rattled across the floor. And they bounced me. They 86'd me. And about 6 months after that, the big lesy purge was on. So I have the dubious honor of being the first head to roll. And since they have not formally apologized to me, and you know how Southern women are, we demand these things be done formally and properly, I will not go back. And I don't know if they'll miss my brain, but they're sure missing my sense of fun.
Do you think that that now still doesn't accept lesbians, although you haven't gotten a personal apology? It seems to me that's become less of a dramatic issue within
now,
and that lesbians are much more accepted, gay rights are much more accepted within the organization.
There's no choice but that it be accepted. If you are asking for equal treatment from the men in this society, you cannot turn around and treat a woman unequally because she is black, or because she's poor, or because she's gay. I mean, if the women's movement is what it says, then we have to practice what we preach. And lesbianism was the first issue that tested that. And, of course, we found out to our great dismay that women could be as piggy to one another as certain men can be to certain women. So it was a big object lesson and a big moral lesson to all of us. And I think we've all learned. And now did make a blanket apology, I think, under Karen DeCrow, to all of the people who were destroyed in that purge. But you know me, just petty and vain, I want it personally.
Okay. What issues have you been working on politically?
Mostly I'm working on my writing. And I'm very concerned with people in communities and how they live and how people emotionally support one another. This is just something I keep at all the time, trying to figure out how and why. I think it relates to my old days as a political organizer when I saw so many things fail because we didn't know. We knew how to get the work done, but we didn't know how to keep one another working. We didn't know how to make those emotional ties successful. I have to raise $5,000. I don't remember if it's a year or every 2 years for the National Women's Political Caucus, which is my commitment, and goes into the general campaign fund, which is then distributed to women running for office without regard to party. As far as the National Gay Task Force goes, I have no official capacity with them, but if they ask me to do something, usually through Gino Leary or Bruce Fowler, I'll do it, you know.
Most of your efforts now are devoted to your writing.
It has to be. Writing and film, it takes up so much energy, and the time it takes to acquire skills, it's a full-time job, and it is labor. And one of the unfortunate things about Americans is they don't consider art labor, and they make it very difficult for those of us who are artists, number one, to economically survive, and number two, to have the support of a community. An artist is as important to the life of a community as an electrician. But we don't give that individual credit for what they give us, and we really have to do that.
Well, you were lucky. You were able to write some of your new book, Six as One, on a grant.
Lucky. It saved my behind. I could not have finished the book without a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. And a year before that, because this book did take a good year to write, I'd gotten a very small grant from the Massachusetts Arts Council. They only give tiny grants. I got $3,000 from them and $7,000 from the National Endowment for the Arts. I still ran out of money because this book cost me $10,000 to research. And I had to borrow money from Linda D'Amico and Colleen Moreland, and bless their hearts, they lent it to me. And they kept me going so that I could finish it. And in my foreword, I mentioned them. I hope that anybody out there listening who sees a struggling artist, who believes in them and has some faith in them, if you don't feel strong enough about a political organization to give them some of your funds, if you have any extra, then turn around and help an individual. Help that person get their feet under them and do the work they can do that benefit all of us.
The patron of the arts system isn't quite what it used to be.
Well, ever since the Middle Ages, it's been downhill for that.
I wanted to mention something that you write in your foreword here. turn to the page. While I'm turning, I'll tell you that I'm speaking with Rita Mae Brown. I solemnly swear, you write in the acknowledgments, never to write in any acknowledgments such sentiments as, quote, and to my dear wife for bringing cups of coffee, mowing the lawn, and enduring my absence from routine duties, my gratitude is boundless. Even if I acquire a wife, you wrote, I promise never to write that.
It's true. Have you ever read the foreword of just about every second book that you read has this sort of little tidbit tossed off to the suffering spouse? It's such a cliche that I couldn't resist making fun of it. But you know, I'm dangerous because I can just turn around and do that same thing to the feminist movement. I can't resist making fun of whatever I'm around. It's in my nature.
Okay, well, Rita Mae Brown, I want to thank you very much for being here this afternoon on Fresh Air. It's been good to see you again.
Thank you.
I've been in the studio with Rita Mae Brown. Her first book was Ruby Fruit Jungle. She has now written a new novel, which is called Six of One, and that second novel is published by Harper & Row. Third novel, what was her?
The second one was In Her Day. It was about the women's movement.
Ah, well, I missed that one.
It's okay.
Okay. Well, this is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.